Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who discusses the changing congressional debate on the Iraq War. Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen, who explains the cause of the spike in energy prices and describes the collaboration of the federal government with energy corporations to boost their profits. And Rob Ritchie, Director of Fair Vote, who talks about Connecticut's new comprehensive campaign finance reform law. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The London-based Guardian newspaper reports the European Union is breaking away from the Bush administration on their global AIDS policy that pushes an abstinence-only agenda. On December 1st, World AIDS Day, the 22 members of the EU released a joint statement on a strategy to fight global AIDS by promoting the use of condoms, needle exchange, sex education, and access to reproductive health services. The Bush administration has pledged $15 billion to fight AIDS over 5 years. However, two-thirds of the funds given out have to go to pro-abstinence programs, and funds are prohibited from going to groups that offer abortion or counseling services. In recent months, AIDS activists have blamed the Bush administration for the growing shortage of condoms in Uganda, the African nation seen as a major success story in the fight against HIV/AIDS. As Stephen Lewis, the United Nations envoy to the African AIDS crisis, lamented, there is no doubt the condom crisis in Uganda is being driven by U.S. policies. He added the Bush agenda is doing damage to Africa. Use of condoms in Uganda has also decreased due to statements by Janet Museveni, the president's wife, declaring that condom distribution encourages young people to have sex. The Washington Post reports the Pentagon is expanding its domestic intelligence operations and looking to conduct its own criminal investigations on terrorism. The Bush White House is considering expanding the power of a little-known Pentagon agency, Counterintelligence Field Activity, which was created in 2002. Based on suggestions by a presidential intelligence commission led by retired Judge Lawrence Silberman and former U.S. Senator Chuck Robb, the administration is working to push the agency far beyond data collection on terror threats to apprehension or detention of individuals suspected or convicted of criminal offenses against the laws of the United States. The Pentagon also wants to allow the sharing of data with U.S. intelligence agencies. Civil liberties groups and some Democrats have opposed the attempt by the Bush White House to expand the military spying on American citizens. As Senator Ron Wyden, an Oregon Democrat, stated, "We are deputizing the military to spy on law-abiding Americans in America. This is a huge leap without even a congressional hearing." Wyden did put a stop to some of the expanded Pentagon power with an amendment to the 2006 Intelligence Authorization Bill. It required a direct request by the military to the Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte, for any data sharing between the Pentagon, the FBI, and CIA, and a regular report to Congress on military domestic spying work. Greensboro, North Carolina, likes to see itself as a trendsetter in the dynamic biracial New South. In the mid-1950s, the city's school board was the first to endorse desegregation after the historic Brown v. Board of Education U.S. Supreme Court decision. However, in fear of riling the Klan, Greensboro didn't actually integrate its schools until 1971. In 1960, Greensboro became a hotbed of civil rights activism when young blacks staged sit-ins at lunch counters at Woolworth's and other department stores. That summer, blacks won the right to pay for food and drink at the lunch counters. However, there is one incident the people of Greensboro do not speak of, the November 3, 1979 massacre of black and white demonstrators by 40 members of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party just minutes before a planned Death to the Klan rally outside the Morningside Homes housing project. The rally was organized by the leftist Workers' Viewpoint Project. The Klan opened fire on the protesters, killing 4 people and injuring 11. According to Mother Jones magazine, court records later revealed local police had an informant in the Klan to whom they had given a copy of the march route and the march permit. At the same time, a police special agent was at the rear of the Klan caravan but did nothing to stop the violence. Later, 2 all-white juries acquitted 6 defendants. In 1985, a civil jury found the city of Greensboro, the Klan, and Nazi members liable for one civil rights violation against one demonstrator, and the city later paid his widow $350,000. 25 years later, survivors organized a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to review the incident. The city's white mayor and local law enforcement refused to cooperate. The commission is expected to issue its report in March 2006. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq approaches, congressional debate over President Bush's divisive war is heating up. Representative John Murtha's call for a speedy withdrawal of American forces from Iraq reflected rising opposition to the war as seen in public opinion polls. The conservative Democrat from Pennsylvania's unexpectedly blunt criticism of the war emboldened several Democrats, such as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, to publicly embrace Murtha's message. The Pentagon's recent admission that it had paid to have pro-U.S. stories published in the Iraqi press added to the sense that the White House optimism on the war was simply an extension of a foreign and domestic propaganda campaign. President Bush, reacting to increasing criticism of the war, recently delivered a speech at the U.S. Naval Academy labeled a plan for victory. But the address simply repeated many of the administration's old talking points while touting the progress made toward training Iraqi soldiers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leslie Kagan, national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, the coalition that has had a major role in organizing anti-war protests and lobbying efforts. Kagan reflects on the changing tone of congressional debate on the Iraq war and the task of the peace movement to advocate for a rapid withdrawal of U.S. troops.
Well, I think, to be honest, we still have an uphill battle. It's not like, you know, John Murtha speaks out and all the obstacles that we've had to overcome disappear. You know, these things move slowly and there are bursts of energy and, you know, moments when things break through and you reach a new level of the struggle and of the work. And so I think what's happening is that hopefully more people in Congress are going to find their backbone and feel more empowered because Murtha has stood out there, and continues to stand out there. His positions are very consistent and clear for the last few weeks. So hopefully that will encourage other anti-war, not only Democrats, but some anti-war Republicans to speak out also. And that will, you know, the more that they're speaking out in Congress, the more pressure that puts on the White House. But we cannot, as an anti-war movement, we cannot rely on the United States Congress to do our work. We have got to keep the pressure on, and that means directly on the Bush administration and on the Congress. We have to, you know, move on at those two fronts at the same time. And by put the pressure on, I mean the demonstrations, the marches, the vigils, the civil disobedience, the rallies, all the kinds of ways that we gather, sometimes in small numbers, sometimes in large numbers, but to keep a visible presence out there. And we've also got to find the other mechanisms for making that anti-war sentiment that we know exists in every community of the country much more visible. So, for instance, something as simple as lawn signs. United for Peace and Justice is producing lawn signs. They should be ready for distribution sometime this week. A simple sign that people can put on their front lawn of the house that says, end the war. People need to wear the buttons. I know it sounds corny, but it actually does make a difference. You begin to change the climate and the culture around you where more and more people can speak out. So we still have a long way to go. This war is far from over, but we also have to, you know, acknowledge that our work is paying off, that we are making a dent, and that if we keep at it, our numbers will grow, and through that process, we will be able to mount even greater pressures both on the Bush administration and Congress.
And what about the president's and many of his allies in the Pentagon, their call for a slow, sure process of what they're calling Iraqization of very similar to what President Nixon was calling Vietnamization back in the Indochina War.
There's no end in sight in the kind of plan that the president laid out. I wouldn't even call it a plan. That's too much of a word. One of the problems here is that they went into this war never understanding what kind of response it was going to generate, that it would generate a resistance and an armed resistance, and people would fight back. They never factored in that after an initial invasion and an initial shock and awe campaign, you know, what the reaction would be from the Iraqi people. They never figured that out. We do not condone or accept or appreciate or like in any way any form of terrorism. You know, we condemn all forms of terrorism, but we don't believe that you fight terrorism by starting a war that's based on lies against people that, in fact, did not commit any acts against you and were no threat. Again, we hold by our call for the U.S. to leave and to bring all the troops home now, to leave immediately. Let me just say one thing. Obviously, when we say leave immediately, no one is naive enough to think that overnight you pull out 160,000 troops and all the equipment and armaments and everything else. When we say immediately, you know, we understand that it takes a little while to move that number of people and that much equipment. But the process has to begin immediately. It can't be, you know, 6 months down the road or a year down the road or when the Iraqis are somehow magically, you know, ready to take care of business and to, you know, to protect themselves.
It seems that the Democrats, generally speaking, Hillary Clinton, who's got presidential ambitions, former Democratic Party nominee John Kerry, and certainly Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, are either allied with the president directly in the case of Lieberman or are offering very little difference between themselves and the president's policy in Iraq. What has to happen, you think, to have a real opposition party here that can challenge the president's Iraq policy?
I do think in the short run that people like Hillary Clinton, who is up for re-election this year, you know, in terms of her Senate seat, and this clearly has aspirations to run for the presidency, they have to hear from people. She, for instance, has to hear from people in New York State, her own constituents, but she needs to hear from people all around the country, that we want her to break with the Bush administration on the question of this war. And there's a lot of other issues, too, she should be better on, but certainly on this war. And I think people have to keep the pressure on. I should say people also have to keep the pressure on those members of Congress who are even taking a better position and who have come out against the war. They need to know that their constituents stand behind them, because they're going to get pressure from the right wing and from the people who support the war. So we have to keep encouraging them to be speaking out against the war. And in that vein, I would just want to encourage everybody who's listening, take a moment. Call your representative, call your senators, even if they already are against the war. Call them and say, thanks, you're doing a great job. We want to hear you saying more against the war. Certainly if they're supporting the war, they need to hear from you. And if you can't call, you know, send an email, send a fax, do whatever you can to send a message to Washington.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. Contact the Nationwide Coalition of Peace Groups by calling area code 212-868-5545 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. After Hurricanes Katrina and Rita battered the Gulf Coast, energy costs spiked, with gasoline rising to more than $3 a gallon. But prices have since come down, now ranging between $2 and $2.25 a gallon. Heating oil prices have seen similar fluctuations, but are still at record levels. As winter approaches, local governments and nonprofit community groups are greatly concerned about the high price of heating oil and natural gas, predicting that low-income families will be facing desperate circumstances long before the heating season is over. Allegations of price gouging have outraged many Americans after big oil companies reported record profits. ExxonMobil had third-quarter profits of $9.9 billion, up 75% and the largest in U.S. corporate history. Together, the major oil and gas companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 Index have earned more than $20 billion, up more than 50% from a year earlier. Record energy profits have led some in Congress to call for a windfall profits tax, while others have asked the oil companies to contribute a portion of their earnings to assist the needy. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He explains the cause of the energy price fluctuations and describes the collaboration of the federal government with energy corporations to boost their profits. Companies that, he says, not coincidentally, have since 2001 contributed $54 million to politicians at the federal level, 80% of it to Republicans.
Natural gas and home heating oil prices were on their ways to record highs long before Hurricane Katrina. The hurricane gave cover to a lot of energy traders in New York to push the prices of these commodities well above any previous high price mark. And what that means is homeowners and renters this winter will be facing the highest home heating prices in history. And these high prices are coming at a time of record profits for natural gas and oil companies. And so far, the United States Congress and the White House have failed to provide adequate protections to consumers from these record high prices this winter. In fact, the United States Senate explicitly rejected legislation just before Thanksgiving that would have enacted a new tax on wealthy oil and natural gas companies and used the proceeds to finance an expansion of home heating oil and natural gas assistance for low-income consumers this winter. Public Citizen, along with federal investigations, have clearly documented price gouging and anti-competitive practices by the largest oil and natural gas companies. Those anti-competitive practices directly lead to much higher prices for consumers. And when consumers are paying record high prices, we have also shown that oil companies and natural gas companies are enjoying the biggest profits in their histories. So there's a clear direct connection between the record prices that consumers pay and the record profits enjoyed by oil companies.
So are they doing anything illegal then?
So far, we don't have evidence of illegal behavior. What we do have evidence of are anti-competitive practices that thus far do not violate federal antitrust law, which is why we are calling for strengthening antitrust law to make these types of actions by large oil and natural gas companies illegal.
You've been talking mostly about oil companies. What about natural gas companies and their practices?
For most large oil companies, they have huge involvement in natural gas markets. ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Texaco, ConocoPhillips, Shell, they are all the biggest natural gas producers in North America. So when we're talking, and they also are the biggest crude oil producers in North America. So when you talk about prices of oil and natural gas increasing, that benefits big oil companies because they are involved in both oil and natural gas.
If the sharp increase in gasoline prices was due mainly to price gouging and profit taking, then to what do you attribute the sharp drop in gasoline prices over the past month or so?
Well, actually, I think a lot of it has to do with the political pressure that started to arise. I mean, the prices started to drop as soon as Congress announced that the five CEOs of the major oil and natural gas companies would be brought before Congress. The prices started to drop as soon as members of Congress started introducing windfall profits tax legislation that would tax away some of those record high profits.
So are there any other moves in Congress to cushion the price shocks in heating fuel that are expected this winter?
Well, in the Senate has put together a large spending bill. It's Senate Bill 2020 that the senators included two new tax provisions that would increase taxes on the oil industry by about $4.5 billion over the next couple of years. One of the provisions would actually revoke a big tax break that was just passed by Congress in July in Bush's energy bill. So I think that that tax money coming from the oil industry could be used for rebates. But other than that, we're not seeing any other calls for major investigations into anti-competitive practices on the part of oil companies. We're not seeing any calls for windfall profits tax. So in that sense, the oil industry, I think, dodged a big bullet.
That was Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at Public Citizen, a Washington, D.C.-based public policy organization. Contact Public Citizen at area code 202-546-4996 or visit the group's website at www.citizen.org. In recent months, congressional Republicans have been embroiled in multiple financial scandals, including the indictment of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay on money laundering charges and the Securities and Exchange Commission investigation into possible illegal activities by GOP Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. A federal probe of Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff may well develop into one of the most damaging congressional scandals in recent U.S. history. States such as Ohio, Illinois, and Connecticut have seen mayors, state legislators, and governors convicted on financial misconduct charges. Connecticut's former Governor John Rowland is now serving a one-year prison sentence for accepting gifts from state contractors. Now, after several years of failed reform bills, the state of Connecticut is poised to enact one of the nation's most comprehensive campaign finance laws. The measure, supported by Connecticut's Republican governor, will ban political contributions from lobbyists and state contractors and establishes a system of publicly funded campaigns for legislative races beginning in 2008 and for the election of governor in 2010. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Rob Ritchie, director of Fair Vote, who discusses the strengths of Connecticut's new campaign finance reform law and the flaws which critics, including former GOP U.S. Senator and Connecticut's independent Governor Lowell Weicker, say discriminate against third parties.
It's the result of years and years of activism by some very passionate, well-informed, well-intentioned people who have really should be very proud of this accomplishment, which is, you know, the first time that a state legislature has passed a public financing legislation that covers their own offices. So they are opening themselves up to challenges in their primaries and general elections. And as we know, legislators can be a little leery of doing that. So that took a lot of persuasion, a lot of fortuitous developments. It was unexpected that the governor weighed in as she did earlier this year, and you know, people kept pushing and pushing. And the bill, it's a pretty tough threshold to get public financing, but it's a reasonable one. And so, you know, candidates who have grassroots support and are running within a major party have a very, you know, reasonable chance to get significant funds to run credible campaigns. And there's several provisions that deal with sort of the supply sides, some of the restrictions on giving that I think campaign finance advocates feel very good about. But, you know, the one that I guess I'm most interested in is that this will be a means for candidates who don't have that easy access to money to run credible campaigns, at least within the major parties.
What kind of impact do you think this move on the part of the state of Connecticut will have nationally in terms of possibly being a model of some kind to other states?
Well, it's a real shot in the arm for the public financing movement. There were victories a few years ago at the ballot box in 96 in Maine and in 98 in Arizona. And then it's been a long time for a win for state legislative offices and gubernatorial offices since then. There were some defeats statewide and some other pushes in state legislatures that fell short, New Mexico and some other states. And I think some of the big funders who had put a lot of money into campaign finance reform have begun to be, you know, thinking that it's going to be too tough to do. But there's been some smart work on this. There were some strong wins in cities. The city of Portland went to a similar system there, and the city of Albuquerque voted it in handily this year. And I think groups are definitely going to try to build on this and see if they can push in other states. There have been some states that have done specific sort of targeted public financing, like for judicial elections in North Carolina and other changes that have been good. But this is the first comprehensive bill in quite a long time.
Now, as for some of the flaws in this bill, most notably, there's been criticism about the provision for public financing that creates kind of a second-class citizen situation for third parties, parties that are not Democrats or Republicans. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's rather shocking, actually, that at the same time that they could be doing something that I think is as clearly pro-democracy as opening the field to more candidates challenging within the major parties, they put in these really draconian measures that make it pretty much impossible for any third party or independent candidate to qualify for full public financing and very tough to even get any public financing. So in a race for governor, well, basically for any race, but the one for governor is where the numbers are biggest, is you have to get signatures from at least 20% of people who voted in the last race for that office. So if you're talking about a race for governor, getting 20% of the people that voted in the last governor's race to sign a petition saying that they want you to qualify for public financing is an extremely difficult, pretty much impossible task to do. You actually probably would have to get 30% signatures because some ballot, you know, some signatures wouldn't be valid and so on. And, you know, it essentially means that it wouldn't happen. Lowell Weicker has jumped in to already sue against that or sort of pledging to sue and looking into it. And we talked to some law professors who have looked at it, and it's pretty much just, you know, it's a straightforward violation of equal protection. And I think it's founded on this belief that, you know, we don't want those third-party candidates and independents kind of messing things up in general elections. And I think that the whole point of a public financing system is to get new voices in the process, to get new energy, to get some new ideas debated, and that's what our public dollars should go to. It shouldn't just be a means to prop up the major parties. And I think we're learning the wrong lessons from some of the high-profile presidential campaigns of the last few years, Ralph Nader and so on, that Democrats who steered this bill through the legislature probably don't like Ralph Nader much, but the way to handle a third-party candidate is not to discriminate against them, but to accommodate them. And that's what we would like to see a state like Connecticut do, instant runoff voting and look at proportional representation, systems that don't try to deny choice in a way that almost certainly is not constitutional, but to try to accommodate it. And that's what these systems do.
That was Rob Ritchie, director of Fair Vote, the Center for Voting and Democracy. Contact the group by calling area code 301-270-4616 or visit their website at www.fairvote.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.